What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, episode 101, MRSA update with Dr. James Muntz. Dr. Muntz had to fit in the interview before his lecture, so the interview comes before the lecture because right after the lecture he had to leave to discuss MRSA issues there at the Texan Stadium. So Dr. Muntz works with the Houston Texans, and we're thankful that he got to squeeze us in at the 13th annual Sports Medicine Update from Memorial Hermann. And so, again, I want to thank Bob Marley and the whole team there at Memorial Hermann for letting us jump in there. Definitely want to thank Bill Hale and Mark Knobloch and Josh Yellen for all the work they did with the interviews. My students, Jasmine Dozal and Sarah Avina, for all the work they did with the recording. So at the Sports Medicine Broadcast, we want to ask that you would give us some reviews and some ratings there on iTunes so that we can help other people find this. And also be sure that you look at the website for the live webinars starting in September. So the live webinars, that can, that way you can earn your CEUs and it keeps track of your time and everything like that. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com has all the information. I am Jeremy Jackson, the host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, we're going to try and make this a practical approach. Some of this stuff is pretty high-end as far as scientific or numbers, and we'll keep that down to a minimum and try to talk about what you guys and ladies see in the clubhouse training room, the athletes that show up, what we see, and so on and so forth. This is made probably the things in sports medicine that have gotten a lot of attention lately medically. Or concussions, head care, chronic problems with concussion, and the other big issue is MRSA, or MRSA, that stands for methicillin-resistant staph aureus. I take care of three of the professional sports teams here, baseball, football, and then the Rockets. Probably 10 or 11 years ago, when we first started seeing this, I thought with the Texans, we thought the players, 10 years ago, we thought the players were coming in with insect bites. They had a red spot. I'll show you some pictures later. We thought they got them from the turf, from out playing. It became very obvious over the next 6 months or a year what this was. And so we saw a number of these cases early. We probably saw 15 or 16 or more in a season with one sports team. I probably saw one last year. We've done a good job of prophylaxis, getting people away from the facility if there's an issue. So we'll cover all this, and we'll cover any questions and answers. I talk pretty fast, so hopefully you guys can keep up or raise your hand or something if I'm going too fast. Where are we today with this? How did we get here? Here is a Newsweek magazine about antibiotics. We had all these fancy drugs that come out. Now we have fancier organisms that resist. They develop resistance to cell wall issues, RNA, DNA, and they become resistant to these multiply expensive antibiotics that we have developed and used. Here's one from Newsweek. We've got to give fair time to also the Time magazine. Review the killer microbes. Are we losing the war against these different organisms? MRSA in sports, is there an epidemic of this? Does it need to be reported? Should the CDC get involved? So on and so forth. So invasive MRSA, nobody cares about these numbers much, but here's some different numbers. HA, if we abbreviate, that's hospital-acquired MRSA. Some of those are tough to treat. They've already been exposed to antibiotics in the hospital. So it's a little bit different animal than community-acquired. So we have, you know, any of our football players, these are obviously community acquired. If they get an MRSA in the hospital after knee surgery, Achilles tendon surgery, ankle surgery, that may be hospital acquired. It's very important because if people work with this, want to know about antibiotic susceptibility. Mortality, there's deaths from this. 18,000 to 20,000 deaths back in 2005, 9 years ago. Back in 2005, about 132,000 deaths from pneumonia, so you can see that as a comparison. Here's a comment from director of the CDC, where he calls MRSA the cockroach of bacteria. We got this term from Bob Marley. He was called me a cockroach for a while. So we pushed it on over to the antibiotics. Public's very anxious. If you do need young people, high school, people are very nervous if their kids get something like this. So it's important to be aware of new treatments, new things we ought to be doing. Here's the historical timelines. 1880, first staph aureus discovered. No antibiotics were any good until 1940. That's when penicillin came out. All these people that got sick back in the railroad days, western days, there were no antibiotics anybody could take for the infection. So you could die from a pharyngitis, sore throat, strep throat. Nothing to treat these people with. 1955, 50 years ago, there was epidemics of the staph across the hospitals in the United States. Get more timelines, 1950s, first MRSA isolate, 1960, 1980s, had a bunch of house hospital outbreaks, USA, Australia, Ireland. And then here's these things with different strains. This is significantly a big deal to you guys. USA 100, USA 400, they're different strains of MRSA. The community acquired is a 300, that's probably the most common bug that you're going to see out in your area. Differentiation of staph and strep and coag, positive and negative. Coagulase positive or staph, aureus, coag, very serious type of bacteria. The absence of coagulase production, those are what people might term benign staph, MSSA, methicillin sensitive staph. Easy to treat, or easier to treat, multiple different antibiotics that you can use against that. Here's the autoclave to take back to your lab days in biology in high school or college. The plate on the left has a little yellow tinge to it. That's coag positive. On the right side, you've got clear bacteria. What's the difference? That's a coag negative staph. Virulence, that's how dangerous these organisms are, how active and hard to treat they are. Coagulase negative staph, again, is not as hard to treat. Works against a bunch of antibiotics, works against it, so it's not nearly as serious as an MRSA infection. USA 300, here's one other big term we'll use here, PVL. It's Pantene, Valentine, Leukocidin. That's a virulence factor. That's more academic, not something that you're going to see out in the community. MRSA versus MSSA. Again, the bad stuff's the MRSA. The MSSA would be pretty well treated. Different organisms, general population, coag negative staph and strep. People that are carriers here, different population groups that are at risk. Hemodialysis patients, insulin-required diabetics. IBDU stands for intravenous drug users. Hopefully you're not seeing that on your college campuses. HIV patients, hospital patients, employees, and people with eczema and chronic skin disease. They have a propensity to get these infections. Here's a terrible looking skin outbreak. Somebody with eczema, and they've had some outbreaks of staph across the eyelid. Probably you get somebody like that needs to be in the hospital, high antibodies, but try and treat that as an outpatient, they will get sicker and sicker. Here's another infection that comes across the scalp. You see these blisters where they've scarred. These are a little later in the infection after they've been treated. You can see where it's a good story. Here's a baby, scalded skin syndrome, significant staph infection. So here's comments on recurrent staph peritonitis. These are people with staph infections that get in the hair follicles. They've got multiple areas of red, swollen, look like little areas of pus. Again, be sure to notify your physician, team physician, community physician, or the doctor that obviously cares for this person outside of the playing field. The majority, 80% of community acquired MRSA infections, again, are caused by the USA 300 strain. Antibiotic resistance, as we showed you this timeline, as we got through 1980, 1985, 1990, we had great antibiotics, and these bugs have outsmarted us and become resistant to the different antibiotics that we use. Community-acquired MRSA, boils, pus, not only are the antibiotics important, one of the most important things to treat this with is surgery. Debridement, open up the wound, get your surgeon, primary care doc, medical doc to do that. It's a two-fold treatment. Susceptibilities, we'll skip that. Elimination of nasal carriage. We use Bactroban, Eupiricin, to be put in the nasal area once a day for a week or two, 2 or 3 weeks out of a month. Rifampin can be used orally. That helps get rid of people that are immersed in carriage. If in the hospital, if we have several different patients from a solo doctor, surgeon, that get infected, oftentimes that physician is cultured to make sure they don't carry MRSA. Do I recommend this to do this for a whole team, not at the present time? If you have 10 or 15 people at your school that get MRSA, yes, it's probably a good idea to test the number of people. You can get recommendations from your doctor on who all should be tested. Clindamycin, Cleacin, excellent drug for treatment of MRSA. Here's two different things. So if your patients or players show resistance to erythromycin, they're probably going to be resistant to clindamycin. One thing good about clindamycin or Cleacin that you should remember, it's very good against MRSA, and it also will treat strep. So if you're not sure if these people have a staph or a strep infection, it's a good antibody because it treats both bacteria. Here's a classic looking MRSA, early lesion, could look like a bite, got pus. They need antibiotics, that area needs to be open, get the pus out. It makes a huge difference on how quickly these people respond. You just give them antibiotics, they're still going to have some trouble. You can make an incision, pinhole, needle, extravasate what you can, watch it daily. We tell the trainers, if you get somebody with one of these, yes, it's fine to put them on oral antibiotics. Tell me every day how they look. If they get worse, fever, pain, we need to know about it. Nighttime, don't wait and treat somebody the next day. It's an urgent problem. If somebody's getting worse, you know, don't hesitate to call your doctor. It's nighttime at work. Urgent care, ER, don't overlook it. They can get mad. Here's Bob Marley's forearm. He's always with long sleeve shirts to cover up his tattoos that he got back in the Navy. A different staph infection. Here's another staph infection. These things can get nasty spread, cellulitis. The last two or three slides, these people probably need to go into the hospital, urgent care, quickly. If it's night, nothing special about nighttime. Somebody gets sick at night, they still need to get taken care of. Don't tell them, wait till tomorrow, they could be critically ill by the next day. So if you're suspicious, something may look bad, 7 o'clock at night, they need to get taken care of. There's no time off in medicine. Treatment of cellulitis, abscess, antibiotics. Most common drugs used, minocycline, tetracycline. What's the downside? You got a young one, middle school, elementary school, they can't take tetracycline. It jacks with their bones, and it can mess up their teeth forever. So be careful. Other thing is sun sensitivity. You got something we're used to. Everywhere there's sun. So if you use tetracycline, you've probably got a 10-15% chance. Sun sensitivity, be careful. Somebody's going to use the drug, give them sunscreen, or direct them to stay out of the sun. Pregnancy, probably not good to be taken now. Next bullet, that's Bactrim sulfa. Trimethoprim sulfa methoxazide. Excellent drug, MRSA. It's Bactrim DS, 1 PO, twice a day for MRSA. Third one, linezolid, that's Zyvox. If you use that, Bob Marley will kill you. It's about $100 a pill. So, good drug. If somebody
didn't get your picture of your arms a little bit ago.
Clindamycin, Cleacin, great drug. It treats staph and strep. That's an advantage.
That's why you wear arms.
Daptomycin, Cubicin. That's a hospital drug. We use vancomycin, we use Cubicin. These are hospital bound. Don't worry about that. If somebody's got a bad infection, fever, the knee's swollen, red, they come to the hospital, they get either IV vancomycin or they get pubis. If they're allergic to vancomycin and had it previously, that would be the next drug of choice. How long does somebody need to stay in the hospital? We start drug, they start showing improvement. If they need a week of this, after 2 or 3 days, home health, they can arrange home antibiotics outside the hospital. This drug's not great against pneumonia, and it's renally excreted. Somebody's got kidney problems, just be careful. Centocid, another drug, only available intravenously, so you're not going to see that as outpatient. Linezolid, that's Zyvox. It's bacteriostatic. You give IVPO, expensive, very expensive. It can cause neuropathy, that's nerve pain, blindness. Probably don't want that as a side effect. If somebody has that, blame Bob Marley. Don't tell him you gave him the medicine. Or give it to the opposing team. That might be safer. But we've never seen that. We don't use this drug that often. It's expensive, but very effective. Minocycline, again, very effective. Doxycycline, great drug, tetracycline, don't use it in pregnancy. And again, don't use it if somebody's allergic to tetracycline. Not good for school-aged kids. Tigecycline, new drug, IV, intravenously coming out on. It's not oral. It will be for bad infections, hospital-only. Drugs in the pipeline, fancy names. There's all these cephalosporins, third generation, second generation, fifth generation, all expensive. You've got them in your notebook and handout. We don't use any of these right now, but just something you can see what's available. Take-home message at PBL we talked about is the only good marker of virulence. The best marker of virulence is if you see somebody that doesn't look too bad, 3 in the afternoon, next day, the redder, they got to go to the doctor. Take a picture on your cell phone, send it to the doctor, bug the doctor, nurse practitioner, make sure somebody's paying attention to this. If they get worse, call them back and keep bugging. This is something you don't want to miss. It's totally treatable, and you don't want it to get out of hand. Community acquired MRSA, here's the drugs, Bactrim, clindamycin. They're resistant to erythromycin lab, don't use clindam. Vancomycin, bullet number 4, or bullet number 3, still useful at workhorse, inpatient. You could arrange for outpatient treatment once you get started. Recurrent thing, we'll skip that. Take home. You can add different drugs to this. Hibiclens and cleaning agents are very important. Last year we had an infectious disease service come out to Reliant Stadium, walk through the stadium, the showers installed, the benches where players were taken care of, to make sure that we do a good job cleaning all this up. Very important. Clean the tables between athletes, all that stuff's looked at. You don't want a player to go home and get a bad infection, tell their parents, nobody ever cleans our place, it's dirty, that take on this. Here, you don't want this to happen. This stuff's all over the newspaper, ESPN, got this off the internet. Falcons, you know, have somebody show up in a hazmat uniform at HBU out here, Second Baptist, with these bad infections. This stuff makes news like hotcakes if it happens. MRSA, Tampa Bay, player, Carl Nix at Tampa Bay, got a toe infection, I think. Ended up getting a bone infection, osteomyelitis, that's bad. They complain, it's in the paper, internet, everybody sees this stuff. MRSA, Tampa Bay and the NFL, this is taken out of the newspaper. Third Tampa Bay player, test positive for MRSA. So, you know, there's a lot of attention that's shown to this stuff, so you gotta be careful, scrutinize everything. Anything looks funny, get these people to see the doctor. MRSA, Tampa Bay Bucks. MRSA infects some Tampa Bay players. They were going to cancel one of the NFL games. That's a lot of money for something like that to happen. The reason I'm showing these is to show you there's a lot of public attention to this. And that's it. We've got time for a couple questions.
Hey, welcome back to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This is, again, Dr. Josh Yellen for the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program. I have with me today Dr. James Muntz. Dr. Muntz, thank you very much for joining us.
Testing one. That's all I know about radio.
Yeah, that's right. Across from me is your host and founder, Jeremy Action Jackson. Jeremy, how are you doing today?
Doing great. It's good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks. Dr. Muntz, I want to ask you a few questions. We know that obviously you're here from Memorial Hermann, the Ironman Sports Medicine Institute, and we're collaborating with UT physicians. And I want to ask you a little bit about you, your background, your bio, and how you got to where you are.
Okay, I'm originally from Tyler, Texas. Went to Indiana University for undergrad training. Went to Baylor here in Houston for medical school and residency. And as far as sports affiliations, I started out with Houston Gamblers, Houston Oilers for 10 years.
Who are the Houston Gamblers?
Old school, USFL football team with Jim Kellett was their quarterback.
Oh, yeah. I saw an NFL show about that.
And Houston Oilers, Gamblers, indoor football, outdoor, arena. I've done Dynamo for a couple years. I've done the team doc for the Houston Rockets for 20 years. I've been the doctor for the baseball Astros for about 12 years. So my wife, I told her I have an hour and a half off a year when there's not a game going on.
Yeah, that's right.
She said it's too much time off. I'm wasting my time.
And so tell us a little bit of background. You know, the other day, yesterday, we had Dr. Bajani sitting in the seat, and you and Dr. Bajani are both going to serve as co-medical directors for our new Master of Athletic Training program. So thank you very much. And so tell us the difference of your training so people that are listening can understand the difference. Dr. Bajani is family medicine. He did a family medicine residency, and he did a sports medicine fellowship, and you're internal medicine. Is that correct? So tell us a little bit about the differences between the two and how that applies to your knowledge of what you do with the athletes.
In a nutshell, what Dr. Bajani does is family practice different from internal medicine. They take care of youth, youngsters, elementary school on up. As an internal medicine doctor, we don't usually take care of people until they're 15 or 16 years of age. He's a sports-trained guy. I'm an internist who I would describe myself as. I take care of medical problems for sports people and athletes.
And so let me ask you just a couple differences from the internal medicine side. You know, you said that you take care of adults that happen to engage in physical activity or, you know, athletic performance. What are some of the main issues that you're seeing today in the sports medicine field? Because you've said, obviously, you've been around for decades. How has that changed? What other things have you learned from the time that you came out of your residency training?
Probably the most common things we see people for are daily injuries, overuse injuries, soft tissue things. Anybody that has a significant orthopedic injury, shoulder dislocation, bad knee injury that we can't take care of. We work along with orthopedic surgeons with that. A whole lot of attention to concussions now that I didn't see stuff with 20 years ago with this kind of deal. A lot of attentions to minor illnesses, the flu, mono, sore throats, pharyngitis, headaches, migraines, asthma that could affect somebody during school, during the performance or whatever, and we, you know, probably it's most often what we see.
So I want to go back a little bit. You know, we've talked to a number of different physicians and other medical professionals, and it seems like there are a number of different ways that somebody can get in the sports medicine field, right? Obviously, you can be an athletic trainer, you can be a PT, and you can be a strength coach. But really from the physician side, it sounds like you could be an orthopedist and go into sports medicine training. Or you can be family practice, internal medicine, pediatrics, physical medicine, and rehabilitation. And there's a lot of overlap, it sounds like, between the professionals. So, for instance, one of the things that you said is 15 and 16 up. And so 15 and 16 can also see a pediatrician, correct?
That's correct.
And so what would be the difference between an internal medicine physician seeing a pediatric patient and a pediatrician seeing a pediatric patient? And the only reason why I'm asking is that you have a lot of people that are listening to the show that may just be getting into the field, and that, you know, or they've just graduated as athletic trainers and they're trying to assemble their medical team, and so they're trying to figure out the differences.
The biggest thing that a 15 and 16 year old kid will come see me for is they're your size, and they said, I'm not going to sit in those baby chairs or get in the train in my pediatrician's office anymore. So they want to leave and get a big man doctor. because they don't want to go to the pediatrician anymore. So that, you know, there's a comfortable transition with that. Huge crossover between the stuff. The sports guys like Bojani and them are great because they do, you know, all the medical care for elementary school, middle school, so forth, and would obviously pass them on. It was an orthopedic issue, critical surgery, that kind of thing. I guess it, at my level, and I've seen some of the other NFL team positions, NBA docs, we're internal medicine, and I think we have a fairly sophisticated training program that's good for adult level, you know, cardiac stuff, respiratory asthma, blood issues, things like that. We have pretty intensive, comprehensive training. Both Johnny's guys and people that are sports trained are very comfortable being the team docs for these middle school, high school, college, and certainly pro teams that more and more sports trained guys are doing sports. And the NFL, as of now, when I eventually stop, every doc I think the NFL has to do family medicine or internal medicine, and have a subspecialty in sports.
They have to be fellowship trained in sports.
Yes.
So going back to NBA, so let me get this straight. You've been with the NBA, or you are with the NBA, the NFL, and Major League Baseball. Can you expand a little bit about some of the major changes that you've seen over the last 10, 20 years in the care of these athletes, but more importantly, your interaction with the athletic trainers?
Tough question. Just more attention to detail. Athletes' interaction, better nutrition, better exercise programs, on down to something that people may not pay a lot of attention to, their records, record keeping, pill keeping, pill ingestion, supplements, anti-inflammatories, the records, the detail, side effects, complications, explaining this to the athlete, the athlete's parents, to the agents. I mean, it's got more and more expanded in that nature. I think people are very aware of information, internet, things that they can come up with. So I think our job's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, taking more and more time with more attention to detail.
And so can you, I'm sorry, Jeremy, do you have a question?
No.
So can you talk a little bit about, as a team physician for some of these pro sports, and I'll kind of give you a scenario, right? You're the team physician for one of the pro sports, and I'm the head athletic trainer for one of these pro sports. Can you talk about the interaction? Because, you know, yesterday morning we also talked to Dr. Lowe, and he sat in this seat. And so it sounds like, right, for all those that are listening and trying to figure this out and building these various sports medicine teams, we have a team orthopedist, and that's Dr. Lowe. And then we have a team physician, right? So we have a team surgeon, team physician. So tell me a little bit more about your interaction with those head athletic trainers that maybe Dr. Lowe wouldn't have a conversation with, and vice versa.
I guess in my experience, the trainers are the guys or the ladies that are on the scene when there's an injury, illness, and they're in charge of directing where the player goes. Somebody obviously tears up their knee, and I'm the co-doctor with Dr. Lowe. That goes to Walt, it goes to Dr. Lowe. Somebody's got fever, illness, cough, chest pain when they're working out, dehydrated, usually that's directed to me more than the orthopedic surgeon or to Bojani or whoever your sports person is.
Right, so it's really talking about, okay, we're going to take, yes, you are all physicians, and some are orthopedically trained as surgeons, and some are trained as physicians in non-orthopedic injury. Can you talk a little bit about a big term that's been going around for a while now is the non-surgical treatment of orthopedic injuries? And so all of us in the field know what that means, but there are some people that are listening that don't quite understand. What's non-surgical treatment of orthopedic injuries?
Probably, again, to summarize quickly, not spend a bunch of time, would be to pick the knee. Somebody hears a pop, tear, can't walk, that's going to the orthopedic surgeon. A runner, marathon runner, long distance, middle distance runner has knee pain, they can still run and so forth. You're certainly not thinking going in a surgical approach with that. I'd say that's a non-surgical issue, knee pain. Dr. Lowe would be very happy for the medical person to look at that before they came to him.
Right, because it's a non-surgical.
Achilles tendon, they've got heel pain, running, heel spur, not going to surgery. The medical guys are very good at dealing with that and addressing.
And in your opinion, over the last, you know, say 10, 20 years of dealing with this, you know, somebody's just coming out of school. Let's say they're coming out of, you know, athletic training school, and they're just embarking on their career in sports medicine. And you were to give them some advice, like some of my graduate students are going to be rotating with you, and you're going to give them some advice of what's it going to take to be successful in this particular profession? What are some of the nuggets? What are some of the pearls that you can pass down?
Obviously, you wouldn't get through this program if you weren't smart and adept at what you do. Probably the biggest things that are important for success are being available, friendly, good communication skills, and first and foremost, the athlete's your patient. So you protect them against themselves, against the trainers, against coaches, from putting somebody back in that you don't think is ready to play. So I hope that kind of summarizes it.
Well, I know that you've got to go give a lecture, so we really thank you very much for your time.
I've got to say one thing in conclusion.
Yes,
testing, sir. 1, 2, 3.
All right. Thank you very much. Again, this is Dr. Josh Ellen for the Sports Medicine Broadcast. And again, Dr. Munson serving as our co-medical director for the program. And you can get the program at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. And you're also now working with UT Physicians, isn't that right?
That's correct.
And so we've been fortunate enough to be able to affiliate with UT Physicians. And so our students can be rotating with you. Good luck on your lecture. Thank you very much for having us. I'm Dr. Josh Yellen for Jeremy Jackson, the entire Sports Medicine Broadcast. Dr. Jim Munson, thank you, sir.
Thanks very much.